We'll go to the Middle East, where Muslims are bombing Christians at Christmas time. We'll look at the infancy narratives and see some Jewish background to the Gospels and take your Jewish-related calls today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on The Line of Fire.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, we are live right here on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, blessed and delighted to be with you. Those who celebrated Christmas or simply had a day off with family, I hope you had a blessed day. And boy, the world doesn't stop being the world. News doesn't stop happening. Tragedies don't stop either. There's a whole lot to talk about on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on The Line of Fire, and I'm here to take your calls. So, maybe you have a day off and you're normally not able to call live during the broadcast. Today you have the opportunity. Here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related question you have, it can be Jewish tradition, it can be related to Jewish background, to the New Testament, it can be a Hebrew question, it can have to do with the modern state of Israel, Messianic prophecy or the like. You may be a Jewish person listening and you don't agree with me and my views that Jesus, Yeshua, is the Jewish Messiah. Well, by all means, give us a call today, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. All my friends listening in greater New York, Long Island, please stay tuned for some very important announcements about what is planned for the island on January 8th and for the island and the city on January 9th, 866-34-TRUTH. We had on Monday of this week our annual Christmas debate, whether it's appropriate and right for Christians to celebrate the birth of Jesus, number one, to celebrate it December 25th, number two, to celebrate it the way we do, number three. We're not continuing that debate today. However, I simply want to point out that the world and those who hate the gospel often associate Christmas with Christianity. A little over a decade ago, there was some intense persecution in India, especially in the state of Orissa, militant Hindu persecution against Christians. Now, it's happened again since then, especially in Orissa and in other parts of India. But this particular year, when we were there early in the year, pastors and leaders were telling us how the persecution began around Christmas time the previous year, or actually it had begun a little bit before that, and then they said that they will be shutting churches down by Christmas and attacking buildings and more importantly, attacking and killing individuals. Well, if you read the news, in Iraq, at least 37 Christians were killed. Now, are they all born again? Did every one of them know the Lord? Were some of them traditional Christians? God knows. But they were attending church services for Christmas when Muslims blew them up and killed them. Why? Because in the Islamic mind, there is an association between Christmas and Jesus. This often happens that Muslims and others that oppose the gospel will attack and kill Christians at this time of the year. So while you may have been celebrating and having family fun, which is good and wholesome and necessary, and while this may have been a spiritual time for you, celebrating the Lord and exalting him in word and song, which is wonderful, let's remember our brothers and sisters, especially in the Muslim world, who have endured much hardship and persecution, often at this very time of the year, in the midst of hostile Muslim climates. All right, I've got a whole lot to talk to you about. Lots of things going on in the news and in the world. Join me for the rest of the broadcast right here on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. It is the day after Christmas, and at this time of the year, it is common for leaders in Israel and other parts of the world to, even as non-Christians, to send out Christmas greetings to the world. Let's hear what Mahmoud Abbas had to say. He is the leader of the Palestinian Authority. Clip number six.
Israeli leaders have reacted angrily after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas published a Christmas card claiming that Jesus was a Palestinian and that Israel is to blame for Christians leaving the region.
Mahmoud Abbas says that Jesus was a Palestinian. Clip number seven.
Abbas released a Christmas greeting calling Jesus Christ a Palestinian messenger. The Israeli Foreign Ministry told the Times of Israel that the statements were an outrageous rewriting of Christian history.
All right. We understand that Jesus Yeshua was a Middle Eastern Jew born in Judea, in Galilee to be specific. We understand, or Bethlehem, excuse me, and then raised in Galilee. We understand that he was born in what was called Palestine for much of the last 2,000 years. But to say he's a Palestinian is historically false, F-A-L-S-E, false, as in false. The country was not named Palestine until after 135, the failed Second Jewish Revolt under the General Bar Kokhba. And one of the punitive acts of retribution by the Roman leadership was to rename the entire region and to use a negative name, Palestine, harking back to the Philistines, who were foreigners and who were enemies of the Jewish people, so as to basically paganize the land, call it Palestine. So to say he was a Palestinian, which has associations with it and which would normally be associated with a Muslim Arab, although there are Palestinian Christians, I understand that, is completely anachronistic and completely misleading and completely false and fails to emphasize he was a Jew and this was considered the Jewish homeland. And Jesus even warned about the coming destruction and the scattering of his Jewish people and their regathering. 866-34-TRUTH. According to Mahmoud Abbas, we celebrate Christmas in Bethlehem under occupation. This Christmas Eve, our hearts and prayers will be with the millions who are being denied their right to worship in their homeland. He called the security barrier an annexation wall, which is stealing Palestinians' land and dooming their future. Can we get this straight? The reason the fence and in some parts the wall was built was to keep murderers out, and it has been largely successful. That is number one. Number two, the fact is the greatest obstacle to Christians in the Middle East is radical Islam. And under Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority, Christians in Bethlehem suffered. Many would speak out more clearly about that if not for the ongoing threat of Islam. Let's go to clips 15 and 16. This is Hanan Ashrawi, who is a well-known Palestinian spokesman. And this is what he has to say about Jesus being, quote, a Palestinian. He's being interviewed by the late Zola Levitt, obviously a Jewish believer strongly committed to Jewish presence in the land of Israel and to a Jewish homeland. Clip number 15.
You said Jesus Christ was a Palestinian prophet born in Bethlehem in my country.
Yes.
I wondered about that.
Well, of course he was born Jewish, but he was a Palestinian because he was born in Palestine. There are still many Jewish Palestinians, of course. But those who chose to be Israeli are Israeli Jews, but there are many, mostly outside Israel, who are Palestinian Christians. There are some who are puristic.
Right. Hannah, of course, she, I said he, Hannah Ashrawi. Wasn't she involved for a while with Peter Jennings? Yeah, believe so. But in any case, when she says, yes, he was a born Jewish, but a Palestinian. No, he was not a Palestinian. There was no such thing as Palestinians. There was no such thing as Palestinian anything. The concept, the notion, the word did not exist. He was a Jew born in his homeland in the city of David. And as a Jew, he would have prayed daily for other exiles to be regathered to the land in all likelihood. Okay, next clip, just a little bit more from Hanan Ashrawi.
He belongs to my heritage, to my past, and we are the most ancient Christian community. And he was a Palestinian, he was a Jew, and he became a Christian.
He didn't become a Christian either. That's the other misnomer. Jesus, Yeshua, did not become a Christian. He lived a Jew, he died a Jew. He lived and died as a Jewish leader. There was no such concept of Christianity. Now, there was even less concept of being a Palestinian, but certainly no concept of Christianity. Jesus came as the fulfillment of the Hebrew Scriptures. Jesus came and was called a rabbi, not a reverend, not as a formal ordained rabbi. That did not exist at that time. That's a generation or two later. But as a recognized Jewish teacher, he would be called rabbi. The misconceptions are quite amazing. Bottom line, though, the persecution of Christians in the Middle East is the fault of Islam, not Israel. And Arabs living within Israel have far more liberty to worship freely, to practice their faith, be it Islam, be it Christianity, be it of the Druze faith, which of course is closer to Islam. They have far more liberty there than in any other Muslim nation in the region. Oh, and far more liberty under the Israelis than they have under the Palestinian Authority or under Hamas. Let the truth be told. Does not mean Israel is guiltless. It means things are constantly being misrepresented. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Nadine in Silver Spring, Maryland. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, Dr. Brown. Good afternoon. I am very compassionate about what your subject is on today. And I will continue to listen, but I wanted to let you know that you are my hero. Last week, when you were on Piers Morgan's show, calling from Charlotte, North Carolina, I want you to know that the questions and the responses you gave were outstanding and true, and he could not handle it. I was so happy to see you, and I just wanted to tell you, you are my hero.
Oh, Nadine, thank you so much for those kind words. That's gracious of you. And, you know, the truth be told, we've gotten a tremendous amount of comments from folks who watched the broadcast who felt similarly that I answered questions the way they would have answered them, that yeah. I was able to be a voice for you. And that's yeah. the big thing. In other words, when I go on there, it's not a matter, when I'm before the secular media, of me trying to look good, of Mike Brown trying to look good, but rather I want to be a voice for the rest of us that yeah. aren't sitting there. Because, you know, sometimes you watch TV or you listen to the radio, you get frustrated. You're like, no, that's not the right answer. You're sitting there and you know there's something better. So obviously the first thing is to exalt the Lord. And the second thing is to rightly represent us. And I'm so glad that we were able to do it. Thank you so much, Nadine. Yeah. That's a blessing to hear.
Thank you so much, and you are a blessing to all of us. Thank you so, so much, and God bless you.
God bless you, Nadine. You know, look, friends, this is why we identify as your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. It doesn't mean that you don't have a voice, because you have a voice in places where I don't. We each have a voice. We each have a role to play. And I don't pretend to say everything exactly the way every one of you would want me to say it, but I do believe that there are things we hold to deeply on a deep common bond foundation in the Lord. And as I speak for the gospel, what does it say in Acts 2? Then Peter stood with the 11. In that sense, when he spoke, They all spoke. In fact, it's a truth I need to emphasize even more. So that's my goal before the secular media and here through this radio broadcast 5 days a week, 2 hours a day, to be your voice, to speak on your behalf, to get a message out to the church and to the world that you can say amen to. So thank you for your support, for your encouragement, for your prayers. We come back, I'm going to get to your calls, and I want to talk to you about what's going to be happening on Long Island and New York less than 2 weeks from now. Can't wait. We'll be right back.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday and the Line of Fire broadcast. 866-34-TRUTH. Any Jewish-related questions you have today, I will be glad to take in the midst of the broadcast. A whole bunch of things I do want to talk to you about. An important New York-related announcement, and just I'm gonna tell you about it. Just something very interesting that happened today. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to the phones. Barbara in Houston, Texas. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, thank you too, Dr. Brown. Before I ask my question, I just want to say I agree completely with Nadine. I love what you did on Pierce Morgan's show. And also, I love my book, Authentic Fire. Got it on Monday. I've almost finished with it already. Okay, here's my... The last 9 chapters in the book of Ezekiel, 40 to 48, do they speak of something in Israel's history? I have been taught that is the millennial reign of Christ. So what is your teaching on that? And if it is future, how do we Christians relate to that?
Yeah, great questions, Barbara. And first, thank you so much for the kind words. And I'm so glad you're enjoying Authentic Fire. By the way, something that really blessed me day before Christmas and Christmas was people posting pictures of Authentic Fire or Hyper Grace. They'd received them as Christmas presents, you know, advanced copies of Hyper Grace and Authentic Fire as soon as it got out. And they were posting pictures on Facebook saying it was the best present they got. So I can't tell you how much that gratified me to see. So thank you. And Barbara, when you're done, be sure to let your friends know about Authentic Fire and encourage them, and you can do it as well, to post a review on Amazon once you finish the book. Okay. Ezekiel 40 through 48, its immediate context is that when the Jewish people would return from exile in Babylon, they would then build this glorious temple, and the Lord's glory and presence would be there, and there would be massive renewal and revival for the whole world. That was the expectation with the return from exile. It did not happen in the way that was expected. It only happened in part. Ultimately, the Messiah did come into the world 500 or so years later. And he did inaugurate the kingdom of God in the world, but he only began the mission. He won't complete it until he returns. So in that sense, even though there was an anticipation for those things to happen by the prophets like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, they only happened in part. That means that Ezekiel 40 through 48 remains a future prophecy. Is it symbolic? It does not line up exactly with some of the Torah regulations in terms of size of temple, tabernacle, etc. And Jewish scholars have debated that, how exactly does it work out. But on face value, it is a future prophecy of the millennial kingdom. Is it symbolic in language, speaking of the presence of God, speaking of worship, speaking of purity, and things like that? Some would argue that it is, and Ezekiel was using the language that he had to speak of a future priestly vision. Others would say no, it is literal, not symbolic. There will be a literal temple. There will be literal sacrifices. That's troubling to some. How could there be literal sacrifices if Jesus died on the cross, was the once-for-all sacrifice, and no more sacrifices are needed? The answer would be that just as the sacrifices before the cross looked forward to his coming, the sacrifices that would be performed in the millennial kingdom would look back to his death on the cross. And in fact, sacrifices continued at the temple for a full generation after he died before that came to an end. So there are Messianic Jews, there are evangelical Christians, Barbara, who believe there will be a physical temple with physical sacrifices and it will look back to what Jesus did on the cross. Others say, no, it is symbolic language speaking of worship and the approach to God. And I cover those issues, if you ever want to study them in more depth, in a lengthy answer in Volume 2 of my series on answering Jewish objections to Jesus, the temple in Ezekiel 40 through 48. And for everyone reading it in the here and now, we can learn spiritual truths from it and ask God to give us insight as we read. Hey, Barbara, again, thank you for the kind words and the great question. 866-34-TRUTH. Wednesday night, January 8th, I'm scheduled to speak at Word of Life Fellowship. This is in Freeport on Long Island, Nassau County, 7 o'clock Wednesday night. After I speak, I will be signing books. You can get copies of Hyper Grace and Authentic Fire. We'll have them there with us to sign. Then, Thursday morning, January 9th, we'll be in Suffolk County. This is for pastors, leaders, and anyone in your congregation, pastor that you want to bring along with you. We'll be at the Gospel Cafe inside Holding Out Hope Church at 9 in the morning. This is in Middle Island, New York. We'll have all this up on our itinerary shortly. And then Thursday afternoon, from 1 to 6 in the afternoon, so whatever time you're able to come, all of our friends in the greater New York, New Jersey area, I'll be joining Kevin McCullough for his American Family Radio TV broadcast, followed by the Line of Fire Live, followed by Kevin McCullough's broadcast. This will be taking place at the American Bible Society in Manhattan. And then after that, I'll be speaking about the new books, Hyper Grace and Authentic Fire, taking your questions face-to-face live. That'll begin at 4, and then signing those books. You'll be able to purchase them there, and we'll be signing them for you. This will be happening between 1 and 6 p.m. in Manhattan, January 9th. So go to WMCA.com for more info on the last event, and stay tuned. We'll be posting all this on our itinerary. So I write an article. It's a short excerpt from my Authentic Fire book. It's called Shall We Burn One Another at the Stake? And it's talking about how we need to learn from each other rather than attack each other. As a result of that article, a guy posts that I am the Jim Jones and David Koresh of today. It's a psychopathic mass murderer, and those who agree with me are not even Christians. This is the very type of thing we are trying to deliver people from, this level of deception and error. And by God's grace, we do that in the Authentic Fire book. We expose these extreme destructive tendencies on all sides of the debate within the body. Say, let's not burn each other at the stake as church leaders did to other church leaders in the past. Let's listen to each other as brothers and sisters in Jesus. Maybe you got a Kindle e-reader or a new smartphone or iPad or PC or something for Christmas. Well, why not download your copy of Authentic Fire right now by going to Amazon.com and typing in Authentic Fire? You can start reading in a matter of seconds. If you're not sure about the book, read the reviews and then go ahead and get it. If you want to stand with us, if you want to help us be your voice of moral, cultural, spiritual revolution and speak to more and more people, this is the last week we're doing this. Your generous year-end tax-deductible gift of any size will send you the print copy, 420 pages of Authentic Fire. But call now, 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. One more time, that's 1-800-278-9978.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much, friends, for joining us today on the line of fire. Hey, Joey, let's get clip 14 ready. Prime Minister Netanyahu's greeting at Christmas time. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you do have a Jewish-related question for me, by all means, give me a call. If you want to take issue with anything, differ with anything, glad to discuss it with you, as long as it is Jewish or Israel-related. 866-34-TRUTH. Straight to the phones. Roy in Charlotte, North Carolina, thank you for calling the line of fire.
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, I really enjoy your show. Yeah, I was always curious about Jesus Christ as he's Jewish. Can you explain, did he take part probably in the Jewish like festivals and feasts, like his religious background as far as that?
Oh, of course, certainly. He did not necessarily endorse every Jewish tradition of his day, and there were different Jewish groups who celebrated things differently. But let's remember, it was his custom to go to the synagogue. That was not something found in the Bible. That was something developed by the Pharisees so that Jewish people in different parts of the world could connect to God as if they were at the temple. We know that he participates in the Passover. And with the cups of wine, it's clear that there is already a Passover order of service in place, and he is participating in that. We see with the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6 and Luke 11 that a lot of that borrows from and adapts the language of the Jewish prayer book that was developing over those centuries, developed much more in the centuries that followed. We see also in John 10, he's in Jerusalem at the time of the feast of Hanukkah, and he is talking about some of his teaching there. The best background for it is Hanukkah, the Feast of Dedication. And then in John 7, we see that he goes to Jerusalem at the time of Sukkot Tabernacles. So even if he was bringing a different aspect, for example, as the water would be drawn and there'd be a water procession through Jerusalem with great festivity, in John 7, he shouts out, "If anyone's thirsty, let him come to me and drink." So he was putting messianic applications on these things. But certainly as a Jew, number one, it was commanded by the Torah that every Jewish male 3 times a year would have to come up to Jerusalem. So if you were living in the land, that was required. He certainly would have done it. We see his parents did it in Luke, the second chapter, bringing him to Jerusalem when he was just 12 years old. So for sure, he participated in Jewish life as a Torah observant Jew. We see even the garment that he wore had fringes on it. In Greek, it's kraspedon. But it doesn't just refer to the hem of the cloak, but rather to the ritual fringes that a Torah observant Jew would wear. And that would be the furthest extremity if someone was trying to touch him, that those fringes would be hanging out. Someone would reach them and touch them, and hence, by touching in faith, would be healed. So no question, he participated in these things. At the same time, we see in Mark 7, Matthew 15, Matthew 23, and other places that he came against Jewish traditions when they made the word of God void or when they added things that brought people into bondage. But otherwise, he certainly lived as a Torah observant Jew and participated in Sabbath observance and the festivals.
Right, because then it was also the Pharisees that gave him probably a lot of trouble as far as, teachings and things.
Yeah, well, the reason would be was because they were all religious Jews. You know what I'm saying? They were
right.
It'd be like a battle today between two different factions of Southern Baptists. You know, they share a lot in common. That being said, let's remember that the Jewish believers also continued to live as Jewish believers after the cross and the resurrection. The difference is they didn't put that on Gentiles. And they understood that this was not the means of their getting right with God. Hey, Roy, thank you for the questions. If you want to read more, my book, The Real Kosher Jesus, I think would be helpful. God bless.
God of burning, cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, let's listen to Prime Minister Netanyahu with his Christmas greeting from Israel.
Merry Christmas to all our Christian friends around the world from Jerusalem. We celebrate Christmas with you. We know the importance you attach to our common heritage, to the state of Israel, and to the city of Jerusalem, where so much of our common history was forged. We have a great past. We have common values. We have the desire to seize a common future of security, prosperity, and peace. So from the city of peace, Jerusalem, I extend the warmest Christmas greetings to all of you. Merry Christmas.
Michael Brown, thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. Not on a Thoroughly Jewish Thursday topic, but just to say we've gotten a tremendous response to the Authentic Fire book. Today and tomorrow are the last days that we're offering it. For your gift of any size, of course, you'll be able to purchase it. Hereafter from our ministry. It's not available in bookstores. This was a special printing that was done for our ministry because we were able to get it out so quickly. And thanks to Excel Publishing for working on that with us. And you can order the ebook if maybe you got a Kindle e-reader for Christmas, or maybe you've got a new smartphone or tablet. Even if you don't have a Kindle e-reader, you can download the Kindle app for free. Say, how do I do it? Well, just go to Amazon.com, okay? You can read this on your computer, whether it's PC or Mac, within a matter of seconds, all right? So if you're into ebooks, and I'm doing a tremendous amount of reading and studying with ebooks these days, then just go to Amazon.com, okay, and type in Authentic Fire. It's a response to John MacArthur's Strange Fire. Type that in. And you can order the ebook immediately, and then you'll see as you're ordering, if you need a Kindle app, you'll see. I'm looking at it right now on my screen, free Kindle reading app. So that's if you don't have the Kindle e-reader. But if you got one of the e-readers, hey, why don't you make it one of your very, very first investments and get a hold of the ebook? And we've already had to do another printing of the physical print book, sold out of our initial printing immediately. And I'm blessed to see that interest. We're having folks read, say, well, I read Strange Fire, now I want to read Authentic Fire. And what people are coming away with consistently is a heart for unity and a heart of humility as we pursue God together rather than bashing and attacking one another. Of course, one of the most disputed issues in the body today is the state of Israel. Should Christians stand with Israel or not? Should Christians stand in support of the lost sheep of the house of Israel when they are not in a position of being a nation that is turned to the Lord? When you can say, well, look, there's prostitution, there's immorality, there's crime, there's drug use, there's injustice, there's political corruption, and the religious Jews are completely opposed to Jesus. There are all kinds of serious issues in Israel. Why do we stand with them? Well, that's a fair question to ask. If it was a matter of Christians should stand with Israel because Israel is perfectly righteous, that would be one thing. It's another thing if Christians should stand with Israel because we recognize that God has brought the Jewish people back to the land of Israel, that there is a satanic attempt to destroy them and drive them out of the land of Israel, and that Christians have often done a terrible job of showing God's love to the Jewish people, and this is a great opportunity to fix that. You can do that while having a heart for Palestinians. In fact, at a youth gathering within, well, just a few weeks back in Israel called Elav to Him, an annual youth gathering that can draw hundreds and hundreds, maybe close to 1,000 young people together to worship. They worshiped in Hebrew. They worshiped in Arabic. They worshiped Israeli Jews and Palestinian Christians side by side. In fact, they sang Hinei Ma Tov U'Ma'anaim Shevet Achim Gam Yachad from Psalm 133. Behold how good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell together in unity. They sang that in Hebrew. They sang that in Arabic. And the people involved with that conference fully believe that God has brought the Jewish people back to the land and that they have a right to be there. At the same time, they want to see justice for all peoples. Others don't see it like this. Let's get clip number 12 queued up, Joey. Yet another Jewish group, James Morris and Press TV, another Jewish group joining two other scholarly organizations in boycotting Israel's academic institutions. We'll talk more about that a little later in the broadcast. But listen to what they have to say. Clip number 12.
The Mandela funeral and memorial service recently, and if you looked at what Nelson Mandela had said while he was still alive, and he was against apartheid Israel, and his group, the African National Congress, even had a representative who had visited Israel, and she had said something to the effect that apartheid regime, or here's a direct quote, strongly responded after he visited Israel, the ANC, she's speaking on behalf of it, African National Congress, responded saying that she has been to Palestine herself and that the Israeli regime is not only comparable, but worse, far worse than apartheid South Africa. And you see what Israel does there is far worse. And I think the American Indians who have basically, you know, passed this group, or the group we're talking about that wants to do a boycott on Israel, sees the way Israel has basically colonized the Palestinians. And it's a comparable analogy to what happened here in America and how the Native American population was oppressed and put on reservations. But the key point, you know, as the ANC had said, Israel is far worse in comparison.
Yeah. A brief recap of history for those who would like it. 1947, the Arab leaders were offered a peaceful arrangement where Jews and Arabs would live side by side in the country. It was refused. Instead, there was an attack launched on Israel to destroy Israel. There's plenty of room in the land for both. Oh, another point of reference. Those Arabs who stayed in the land of Israel under Jewish leadership grew from a couple hundred thousand to over 1.5 million today, and have full equal rights with Israelis in the land and serve in the parliament, even serve in the Israeli Supreme Court. Oh, another fact of interest. It was the Arab nations, the surrounding Muslim nations, who said, we will leave these refugees as a problem for Israel, as a sore spot for Israel. So the 600 or 1,000 or so Arabs who fled what was then Palestine and now developing Israel in the midst of the war for varied reasons. Many of them fled simply to flee from war. Others fled because the Arab nations attacking said a cannon can't distinguish between a Jew and an Arab. So get out. We'll drive the Jews in the sea, then go back to your homeland. And others fled because of Jewish attack against their villages in the midst of the war. The fact of the matter is the surrounding Arab nations not only made no effort to incorporate the refugees and so alleviate any refugee problem. Instead, they created a refugee problem by refusing to incorporate them, rather leaving them as a blight and sore spot on Israel, and then refusing arrangements to live together peacefully thereafter. And by the way, if you ask the Arabs living in the land of Israel, many of whom are hostile to the modern state of Israel and are anti-Zionist, even though they live there, would you rather live under Israeli rule than under the Palestinian Authority rule or the rule of Hamas in Gaza? The great majority will say we would rather live under Israeli rule. I wonder if that says anything to you. 866-34-TRUTH. Tony in Westchester, New York. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire. Hello, Tony. Are you there? Well, we lost Tony, but since his question was one that comes up constantly, recommended books for witnessing to the Jewish people. Obviously, I have a 5-volume series on answering Jewish objections to Jesus. I say obviously for those who've been listening for some time. I have a 5-volume series, over 1,500 pages total, that volume for volume tackles the most common Jewish objections, be it simple general objections, Jews don't believe in Jesus, to more complex issues like the Holocaust, to historical issues like church persecution of Jews, then to theological issues like God's triunity or atonement by blood, then to issues of messianic prophecy, then to issues of objections based on the New Testament, and then traditional Jewish objections. Five volumes dealing with those, so it's quite comprehensive, meant to be read by believers, but then given to Jewish people to read. However, the one simple volume that I highly recommend to anyone wanting to reach the Jewish people with the gospel or to learn more about Jesus the Jew is my book, The Real Kosher Jesus, Revealing the Secrets of the Hidden Messiah. So I encourage you to get that, to read it yourself, and to give it to a Jewish person with questions, The Real Kosher Jesus. All right, back with your calls and more on the call for the boycott of academic institutions in Israel.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us. 866-34-TRUTH. Thanks for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. For those who don't normally get to listen live, maybe because of a Christmas break, breaking your schedule, we are glad to have you live with us on the broadcast. Again, 866-34-TRUTH with any Jewish-related questions that you have. Let's go to the phones. Manny in Beechwood, New Jersey, thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
For the first time in my life, I have an opportunity while I've been dialoguing with a Jewish person. And he's driving me bananas. He keeps telling me that Jesus had to come through to be the Savior, had to come through a human father. And I asked him, well, do you believe that the Bible is the whole word and the truth inerrant and everything else? And he says, yeah. I said, well, you believe in prophecy? He says, yeah, well, I shared with him 7:14, where the virgin was going to give birth, and that's prophecy, and it was a Savior. And he says, oh, no, that's for a word doesn't mean virgin. So he's between human father and not the word being virgin, in his mind, that is. What can I use to counteract him?
Yeah, again, I take these questions up at length in my apologetics books, but the short answer, the first thing you want to tell him is, yes, he had to have human parenting, but he's born of a human mother, not of human father, because he's not just the son of David, he's greater than David. So you show him in Psalm 110, for example, that David's offspring, the Messiah, would be greater than David. Or you show him other passages like Isaiah the 11th chapter, where he will be greater than David. Or Isaiah 9:6, where the child to be born has divine names, and say, how could he be greater than David with divine qualities, and yet the physical son of David? So we can demonstrate that through his mother Miriam, he is descended from the line of David, but he is greater than human. Take him to Psalm 2 and say, even though it's speaking of an earthly king, what does it ultimately mean when God says, this day I have given you birth? There is something greater that is hinted at as well. Regarding Isaiah 7:14, it's initially a prophecy for the days of King Ahaz, having to do with the significant birth of a child whose presence represents God with us to a maiden. Now, the Hebrew word alma does not specifically mean virgin. It does speak of a maiden. It'd probably be unusual, because it's speaking of a young woman, hence maiden, be unusual for someone that age to give birth, as noted by Rashi, the foremost medieval Jewish commentator. But again, it is not explicitly a reference to a virgin birth. Matthew simply recognizes that this prophecy about someone to be born, apparently in the line of David in the days of Ahaz, does not have a clear fulfillment. And so Matthew looks at Isaiah 7, Isaiah 9, Isaiah 11. That's what you need to share with your friend. Well, keep reading. You see, there's a child about to be born in the 7th chapter, now a child born in the 9th chapter, and now this glorious messianic king in the 11th chapter. Could it be it's ultimately all speaking of the same one? Could it be whatever happened in Isaiah's day, there's something greater to happen in the future? And it is a miraculous birth of great significance. And the one born who is a son of David and yet greater than David. And the Bible talks, therefore, about his mother, but doesn't say anything about his father because he has no earthly father. And then as you present these things, obviously the Holy Spirit has to open his heart and his mind. But tell him that right. These were prophecies originally spoken with messianic intent, or originally spoken for the line of David back in the days of those prophets, but the fulfillment goes beyond that. The birth in Isaiah 7 is of greater importance than anything that happened in the days of King Ahaz. And the birth in the 9th chapter is something greater than anything that took place during the days of King Hezekiah. And the same with the 11th chapter. So you say, look, something happened then, but there's something more. And then the Holy Spirit has to help give him insight to see that.
Right. Oh, I appreciate that. I was, I don't know. I know the Old Testament, but nothing, where I could just pull scriptures like you do.
Yeah, well, everyone's going to be challenged. We all have to learn in different areas. These were things that I had to study intensively, obviously, as a new believer, and then over the years keep looking at. So if you want to get into them in real heavy depth, especially Volume 3 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus gets into Isaiah 7:14. But otherwise, just those simple principles to keep looking at the larger context, Isaiah 7, then 9, then 11, and say, who is this ultimately speaking of? Hey, Manny, may the Lord bless you as you share the good news of Yeshua with the Jewish people. You know what? I don't want to rush calls now. I've got another hour to be on the air. You say, yeah, but I don't get your next hour on the radio. No problem. Just go to my website later today, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org, and just click on latest audio. You can listen to both hours and then check on past shows you may have missed. You can also subscribe there for free to get these by podcast. Callers earlier in the show talked about the interview on Piers Morgan last week. If you didn't get to see that, and it's been viewed over 17,000 times on my YouTube channel alone. If you didn't get to see that, just click on latest video. AskDrBrown.org, click on latest video and scroll down and you'll be able to see it. And again, as we come to the end of the year, thank you for your support. Thank you for standing with us. Those of you who are praying, considering, still making a year-end tax-deductible gift, I commend our ministry to you as one that's worthy. Saw a note that came in today from one supporter who thanked us for enabling him to partner with us in the gospel. If you believe in our outreach to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, if you feel that we're helping to equip the body in these critical areas, if you are blessed that we go to the nations and send laborers to the nations, at the same time we stand up for moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution in America, one way you could really help us is with your financial support. Perhaps God's putting it on your heart to become a torchbearer, a monthly supporter, or if you want to help us with a one-time year-end gift. Again, we're doing this today and tomorrow. For your gift of any size, we just ask you to be as generous as you can. I want to send you the print copy of Authentic Fire, 420 pages. I believe you will be thrilled reading it, that your heart will be ignited with truth and light in the Spirit that will help you to help others and grow in the Lord yourself. So your year-end gift of any size, 1-800-278-9978. Or if you become a monthly supporter, same thing, I want to send you Authentic Fire, 1-800-278-9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. Or go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown. That's askdrbrown.org. Go to the website, click on Donate there, and then just where there's a note section, you'll find it. Just request the Authentic Fire book. And thank you for praying with us as we stand here on the front lines as your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. My bottom line today, there's always bad news about Israel. There are always people opposing the gospel. There are always people opposing the state of Israel. God will ultimately fight for both. We'll go to the Middle East, where Muslims are bombing Christians at Christmas time. We'll look at the infancy narratives and see some Jewish background to the Gospels and take your Jewish-related calls today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, I got to tell you, it was really interesting. On Christmas Eve, I was doing some stuff looking online, and there were a bunch of posts in all different places. Facebook, on YouTube, our YouTube channel, and different places, all attacking me from different angles. It was the strangest thing. I mean, one guy says, "You guys," meaning me and others who believe like me, "are heretics and apostates, tares, an offense that makes people sick." This guy was claiming to be a fellow believer. And folks like me were heretics and apostates. And then another guy went after me for a whiny pity party article, which is actually one calling for believers to stand for social righteousness. It was just a flood of things. And I thought, oh, we must be doing something right. We must be doing something right. Michael Brown, welcome to this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you celebrated Christmas yesterday, I hope you had a blessed Christmas with your family, those that were doing it in a spiritual way to exalt the Lord. I pray and hope. Well, I pray that's what retroactive praying. I hope that it was a Jesus exalting time for you. 866-34-TRUTH. You've got Jewish questions. We've got Jewish answers. I do want to get a little bit into the opening chapters of the Gospel of Matthew to talk to you about some Jewish background to the infancy narratives. Many of you heard those read at Christmas Eve services in your churches. So I want to talk about that and talk about some other things happening in the Middle East. As always, Israel is in the news. But first, let's go to your Jewish-related calls, 866-34-TRUTH. Roger in Yonkers, New York, thank you for calling The Line of Fire.
Oh, Dr. Brown, it's a great privilege to talk to you. I'm home from work today, and I rarely get a chance to hear your broadcast, and I'm elated to know that you're out there. And I have a question.
Great.
I was in communication with a former partner of mine, Orthodox, Jewish partner, and we were speaking of our Lord Jesus, my Lord Jesus Christ, and he said that the fact that the Wailing Wall is still up was proof that Jesus was a false prophet, that his prediction, or his prophecy, I should say, of the stones not being erected after, I guess he's making reference to the Roman desecration of the temple.
Yep.
That justified the death that the Pharisees and others sought of Jesus. What would you say to him concerning the Wailing Wall still in existence and that those
yep.
stones did not go down?
Yeah, Roger, thank you for the question, and I'm glad you're able to listen today. That's one reason we especially like to be live on days when folks may have time off of work. Of course, you can catch any past broadcast, Roger, by going to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and clicking on latest audio there. You can also subscribe for free by podcast if that interests you. But how do we address this question, the Western Wall? Jews call it the Kotel, Christians call it the Wailing Wall, Kotel just meaning the wall, and Christians call it the Wailing Wall. If that, in fact, goes back to Jesus' day and is still standing, doesn't that mean, therefore, that his prophecy about not just every stone of the temple, but every stone in Jerusalem being toppled was not true? All right, I'll answer that when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Great day.
is the world is waking up to what is happening here with the way Israel brutally oppresses the Palestinian people, especially in Gaza, an open-air prison of 1.8 million people.
Oh, is that it? So Israel is oppressing Palestinians in Gaza. Problem is not Hamas. Problem is Israel is oppressing the Palestinians in Gaza. We're going to be talking about that and calls for the boycott of academic institutions and academic work in Israel. We'll be talking about that in a little bit here on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the line of fire, 866-34-TRUTH. So back to Roger and Yonkers, who before the break asked me about the Wailing Wall still standing, and people saying if it's still standing, then Jesus is a false prophet because he said every stone will be overturned. There are several levels of answers to that. Number one, the prophecy that we have in Matthew, for example, declares that no stone of the temple would be left standing. And of course, that did happen. The Western Wall was not part of the temple proper. This was an extension to the temple grounds built by Herod, but was not part of the temple itself. And even though when Herod did beautify and build up the temple, the stones were absolutely massive. And because of the Torah legislation that they couldn't be cut on the premises there, they were massive stones that were brought in to the site. And yet those were destroyed. It's one of the most striking historical facts, and one that causes critics to say, well, Jesus didn't really say this. This was said afterwards because it happened so dramatically, how the Romans completely flattened the temple area. That's the first thing. Now, in Luke's gospel, Jesus does say about Jerusalem as a whole that no stone will be left unturned, that everything will be toppled. The problem with using the Western Wall as an argument against the reliability of Jesus' prophecies, if you do that, you have to throw out most of the Old Testament prophets. When the Old Testament prophets spoke, for example, if they said this city will totally be destroyed and everyone will go into exile, it didn't necessarily mean every last person would go into exile. It meant that there would be a massive exile. They spoke in dramatic terms. And in point of fact, the Romans did flatten and level Jerusalem. And it would be the height of absurdity, as my Fire School of Ministry colleague Steve Ault pointed out many years ago, to think of a Jew standing there in the midst of complete rubble and desolation, and the city virtually flattened everywhere, and the temple flattened, and horrific Jewish suffering, just as Jesus had prophesied, just as Yeshua had said, and saying, well, false prophet, there's some stones standing over here. So the fact is that very, very little actually remained standing. Just a little bit here and there, a wall here and there, is testimony to how dramatically these things came to pass. By the way, if you'll read a passage like Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 7, it talks about as the Babylonians destroyed Judea, how every city will be completely desolate and devastated. And there are scholars who struggle with this, and I had to get into this in my Jeremiah commentary, because here's exactly what Jeremiah says. A lion has gone up from his thicket, a destroyer of nations has set out. He has gone from his place to make your land a waste. Your cities will be ruins without inhabitant. Well, there were plenty of parts of Judea that were only relatively touched. Jerusalem was hit much more, say, than other parts of Judah. Parts of Benjamin weren't hit that much. Not every city was laid waste. And some have said, well, how can Jeremiah be a true prophet? Well, it's preserved because there was a dramatic destruction and a dramatic exile. This is not like a newspaper report going from region to region and detailing each piece. It is rather a powerful statement of destruction coming. The same thing with Jesus. This is how the prophets spoke, and his words came to pass with stunning accuracy. That's the fair and honest answer. And anyone who any Jewish person in particular who takes the Old Testament seriously has to recognize that this is how the prophets did speak.
Oh, that's a wonderful answer. Great response.
Right. Thank you so much, Roger, and thank you for listening on your day off. May the grace of the Lord be yours as we come into the year 2014. 866 844-34-TRUTH. Do I want to go to Melbourne, Australia now? No, not now. Let's go to clip number five. Native Americans, who, by the way, in many cases have been very supportive of Israel. I have quite a few Israeli friends who've worked with Native Americans for years, and Israelis have really honored Native Americans. And I remember many, many years ago looking at a little cartoon, an Israeli cartoon from a well-known cartoonist, and there was a picture of some Native Americans, American Indians, talking to some Israelis, and they're saying, yeah, this land for peace thing didn't work too well for us either. In other words, in this cartoon, the Native Americans were painted as identifying with the Israelis and saying, yeah, you give up land for peace and all you end up with is war. So the Israelis gave up Gaza to Hamas without any requirements. And what have they gotten? Thousands of bombs. They have gotten constant persecution and opposition. And they have gotten blamed for the hardships taking place there, even as the Hamas activists are still digging tunnels to Egypt to smuggle weapons in to kill and destroy Jews and making it very difficult for the people of Gaza as well under Hamas. And just look, just a little search for this. See how many Palestinian Authority leaders or members, I should say, have been killed by Hamas and vice versa. Look at the civil war between them. Look at the fact that they are not in harmony except in their hatred of Israel. And ask yourself, is Israel really to blame? But you've had now even Native Americans joining in with the call for the academic boycott of Israel. Clip number five.
Another U.S. group joins two other scholarly organizations in boycotting Israel's academic institutions. The Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, NISA, has urged its members to boycott Israeli academia over Tel Aviv's violation of international law and U.N. resolutions. The Association for Asian American Studies had made the same decision in April.
Now this is something that's gone back a few years. British academics joined in with it some years back. And here are guidelines from, 2004, where Palestinian leaders have called upon intellectuals and academics worldwide to, quote, comprehensively and consistently boycott all Israeli academic and cultural institutions as a contribution to the struggle to end Israel's occupation, colonization, and system of apartheid. The cultural boycott campaign against apartheid South Africa has been a major source of inspiration in formulating the Palestinian boycott calls and their criteria. Well, the reason I'm talking about this today, I haven't gotten into it yet on the air. A bunch of other things were going on and just haven't gotten into it. But December 6th, so barely 3 weeks ago, the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel saluted the American Studies Association, the ASA, their national council in the United States, for its, quote, principled support for the cause of justice in Palestine by unanimously endorsing a resolution calling for the boycott of Israeli academic institutions. This was back on December 4th and then praised by this Palestinian organization on December 6th. This is a miserable, unjust, unfair, misguided act. I repeat, there is more liberty of thought. There is more liberty of religious practice. There is more academic liberty in Israel than in all of the surrounding Muslim nations. And in some cases, in terms of academic liberty and liberty of the press, more freedom in Israel than in the surrounding Muslim nations combined. Yet Israel gets boycotted. Even though Israeli leaders constantly criticize Israel, even though Israeli leaders constantly criticize the prime minister and the government, even though some of the most militant anti-Zionist voices come from Jews within Israel, I mean, that's how much cultural diversity there is in the land. Even though you have religious Jews living in the land who oppose the modern state of Israel, and who believe it's getting in the way of the coming of the Messiah. With all of that, still there is a call for the boycott of Israeli academic institutions, despite the many discoveries, despite the many wonderful things coming out of these academic institutions in terms of medical advances and technological advances and all other types of advances. No! Boycott the evil Israelis. What a messed up world we live in.
Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire, 866-348-7884. First hour, I commented on the views of Mahmoud Abbas that Jesus was a Palestinian, and earlier comments from many years ago by Palestinian spokeswoman Hanan Ashrawi on a similar bent. Talked about a few other things about Muslims recognizing Christmas as a time to attack Christians. Hence, in Iraq, at least 37 Christians blown up. Think of that. You go to a church service in your mind to celebrate the Savior coming into the world, and you get blown up by Muslim terrorists. We need to pray for God's grace for his people in the midst of persecution and for the conversion of many Muslims. Even Prince Charles, that's right, read this last week. Even Prince Charles has recognized that Christians are being persecuted by Muslims. Prince of Wales made his comments after visiting the British branches of churches based in the region. Certainly the case, and glad to see that he has recognized that and spoken against it. 866-34-TRUTH. My friend Mitch Glazer, the director of Chosen People Ministries in New York City, wrote a letter to Biola University in light of the call for the boycott of Israeli academic institutions with the news that the American Studies Association has joined in this boycott. Mitch wrote this, "Dear friends, I do not know if you're aware of the decision by the American Studies Association. A good response is found in the article by Robert Nicholson, an evangelical who lives in New York City and is active in trying to balance efforts, bring balance to the efforts anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian lobby that is permeating our culture, the church, and in this instance, the world of academia. I'll make reference to that article shortly. I do not know if Biola has any ties to the ASA, but if so, it might be a good idea to consider a response." And then he lists some other articles involved, including what Mitch says is a very intelligent response by an Arab professor from Chicago. Mitch says, "I'm wondering about the evangelical Christian academic involvement in the ASA and whether or not individual Christian schools should be made aware of this action." So if people are going to do this, Mitch is saying, well, then let's call them to account, and there should be a response from member organizations. So Faisal G. Muhammad, who is professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in Illinois, says this: "Much of the commentary and the decision of the American Studies Association to boycott Israeli universities has been incendiary. This is evident in the response of Larry Summers, who styled the boycott anti-Semitic in effect, if not in intent, and of Leon Weiseltier, who called it a travesty of academic freedom. The latter quickly earned a commendatory tweet from John Potterist. Bravo, Leon. In such a climate, we should remind ourselves just what is being boycotted. As the text of the Revolution and the Council's explanation made clear, this is not a boycott of individual Israeli academics. It is much more limited, prescribing what in diplomatic terms would be called high-level discussions. The association will not have, quote, formal collaborations with Israeli academic institutions, none of which has taken an official stand against the occupation of Palestine. American academics observing the boycott will not accept invitations from Israeli universities if Israeli academics are ready to speak there is on the condition that the travel not be supported by Israeli government funds. Hey, as much as Professor Mohammed is saying this is not that extreme, every word of what he writes confirms to me has how extreme it is. So he is seeking to bring a fair reading from a Islamic or pro-Palestinian perspective. But he says this, that read a particular way, the boycott symbolically pummels and expels an embodied evil in an effort to consolidate the membership's own self-identification as enlightened and just. There is a word for such a symbol, scapegoat. And he goes on from there and brings some caveats in the midst of it. The article that Mitch mentioned by, Robert Nicholson, Four Reasons to Hate the Jewish State. I'll get back to that on the other side of the break. When we come back, I also want to look briefly at Matthew 1 and 2 and some Jewish background to the infancy narratives. You can expect hostility towards Israel. You can expect hatred towards Israel. You'll generally only get a lot of sympathy for Israel when you have enough dead Jews, hence after the Holocaust or horrific terrorist attacks that would kill and maim Jewish children on a school bus. Otherwise, world sentiment tends to be hostile to Israel and the Jewish people. And even though Israel is surrounded by hostile enemies, making up roughly 650 times the territory that it lives in, and even though some of the surrounding nations say we want to wipe you out and destroy you, still, Israel is presented as the evil Goliath in the region. And those misperceptions lead to further hatred of Israel. Is the boycott, call for the boycott, a surprise? No, not at all. Do I expect things to get worse? Yeah, at a certain point, there could be a temporary peace if scriptures indicate that and everything seems to be okay, after which sudden destruction will break out on all sides. But as I look at it, the ongoing attacks and hostility and even the irrational attacks on Israel by some are to be expected because it's ultimately a spiritual battle. It's not that Jews are better than anyone else. It's not that Jews are worse than anyone else. It is a spiritual battle having to do with the purposes of God that tie in with Israel. One great way to participate firsthand in doing good for Israel and in having your own life changed is to join me on our annual Israel tour. Did I say annual already? Wow, it is our first ever. This will be our first ever. Many people are already talking about, well, next year. Well, we haven't made plans for any years after, but this will be our first ever. We will go to some of the most important sites in the land. We will connect with believers in the land. We will do special teaching. We'll even broadcast the Line of Fire live from Israel. And if you'll compare it to the prices of other tours with other ministries and groups, you'll see the price for ours is very attractive as well, and we'll be staying with great accommodation. So please join me in Israel next year. To do so, go to my website, askdrbrown.org. Even if you just want to find out about it, because we've got to get deposits in soon, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org, and just click on the banner that says Tour to Israel. You know, I've never led a tour before. I've been asked so much by so many to do it, and some Messianic Jewish friends of mine convinced me last year to go ahead and do it. So I'm really excited to do this. It should be the tour of a lifetime. And yes, we will get time together. We'll get to have meals together with our tour group and face-to-face time over the course of the trip. So please join us. AskDrBrown.org. Click on the Israel banner.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire Great to talk with you on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We are live, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Before I get into some of the Jewish background to Matthew 1 and 2, we may go slightly beyond 1 and 2, as we give you insights into what Matthew, as a first century Jew, was seeing there as he wrote. Let me just share briefly with you an article from Robert Nicholson, former U.S. Marine, recent Tikva fellow. So this was someone participating in lectures in Israel, and current researcher whose work focuses on law, religion, and relations between Christians and Jews. This was published in the Times of Israel on December 20th, called Four Reasons to Hate the Jewish State. And he says, this week's news about ASA's boycott of the Israeli academic, of the Israeli Academy, again, ASA is the American Studies Association, which is universities here in America. He says, this has me asking myself once again why so much of the world despises the state of Israel. He writes, as a Christian Zionist, this spite naturally puzzles me, but I think that any logical human being with enough honesty will admit that the animus directed toward Israel is profoundly disproportionate to that country's size and influence in the world. Very true. Even if we accept the tired thesis that Israel is an aggressive occupying power that denies all human rights, we have to admit that Israel is not the only such power. And again, that is, as he said, a tired thesis. And even if we assume that Israel is randomly humiliating and killing people within its borders, which it's not, we must admit that far worse atrocities on far larger scales are taking place all around the world every day. Trying to paint Israel as the incarnation of pure Israel just doesn't seem to pass the laugh test. How can we explain the rage then? How to explain why people on distant continents are ready to stake their professional reputations on public proclamations against the state of Israel? What does a group of academics who work in American, not even Middle Eastern studies, take time away from the important work of 20 young scholars to make extreme arguments in a debate that really doesn't concern them? And he goes on and gives four reasons. Number one, he says, is an intangible yet deep-seated dislike for the Jewish people. That does exist. It does. Friends, I was shocked over 30 years ago in the midst of an outpouring of the Spirit in church where I was on Long Island. Nancy and I were there. God was moving deeply. There was deep repentance, and people began coming to us just having to confess sinful attitudes that these we thought were friends and coworkers. And I remember people telling me that they always hated Jews because, you know, Jewish kid was smarter than them in school, or the parents were richer. I thought, wow, I had no idea this existed among believers in particular, part of the same congregation. So this is a suggestion by Robert Nicholson that one reason that people hate the Jewish state is because of anti-Semitism. He says the sources of this feeling called anti-Semitism are obscure but amazingly persistent throughout history. He said the second factor is widespread opposition to the Judeo-Christian moral order that has its roots in the intellectual and spiritual history of the Jewish people. He said the third factor, closely related to the second, is the desire of many states to subvert the old Anglo-American political order and substitute it with something else. And the fourth factor, he says, in my view, the least decisive overall is the displacement of many Arabs from their homes after 1948. However, one explains this mass exodus, one must admit that it occurred. Palestinians feel a visceral and, in their mind, justified animosity toward Israel for the personal and collective upheaval caused by the establishment of the state and the subsequent acquisition of territory and the defensive war of 1967. But beyond the region, those predisposed to hate Israel for other reasons embrace the Palestinian cause because it vindicates their hatred and justifies their shocking rhetoric. Back with your calls, and we'll look at Matthew 1 and 2.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let's take a look at Matthew, beginning in the first chapter. Many of you heard these texts read. You heard Matthew 1 and 2 read at a Christmas Eve service or the like, and you think of it as the Christian infancy narratives or the Christmas account. Of course, it's better to think of it as the gospel accounts of the birth of Jesus, Yeshua, and as you do, to remember that these are thoroughly Jewish accounts. So let me read to you from the Complete Jewish Bible, the New Testament part translated by David Stern, the Old Testament, he edited an existing Jewish translation. It begins with, "This is the genealogy of Yeshua, the Messiah, the son of David, son of Abraham," or son of Avraham, as he has it. So this writing, in terms of this is the book of the genealogy, you not only have language like that back in Genesis, the book of the generations of Adam, it could be patterning after that, or simply a Jewish genealogical record of the day could be called Sefer Yuchasin, the book of genealogy. So this is something that any Jew would read and would strike him immediately as a thoroughly Jewish document based on these opening words. And notice that Yeshua is presented as the Messiah, that is the meaning of Christ, and as son of David, son of Abraham, quite significant in terms of lineage. And then he goes on, Avraham was the father of Yitzchak, Yitzchak was the father of Yaakov, Yaakov the father of Yehuda and his brothers. And it goes all the way down. And then you have in verse 17, "Thus there were 14 generations from Avraham to David, 14 generations from David to the Babylonian exile, and 14 generations from the Babylonian exile to the Messiah." In order to get that 14 with the last one of them is counted kind of coming and going twice, you could say, to get that 14. Matthew does skip over others to get that as well, which is also common in genealogies. If you compare it to Luke 3, you'll see what's skipped. If you compare genealogies and Chronicles to other parts of the Old Testament, you'll see the same thing. But what's interesting is the 14. Now, we can't prove this, but it's very likely that 14 comes from David, the numerical value of David, Dalet Vav Dalet, which is 4, 6, 4, those letters having numerical value, not in the earliest stage of the Hebrew language, but as it developed. Hence, 4 plus 6 plus 4, 14. So this stands then for David, 14 generations from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the Babylonian exile, 14 from the Babylonian exile to the Messiah. Now, we understand the Jewish custom that betrothal would have to be severed by divorce, just like divorce. In other words, once you were betrothed to marry someone, it was deeper than an engagement in our culture. It was like a marriage. And if someone was found to have had sexual relations during that time, that would be a severe breach, similar to adultery, but not quite on that level. And once betrothed to someone, you couldn't just say, "Ah, yeah, I found somebody I like better." You'd actually need to go through divorce. So this utter scandal when Miriam, who was betrothed to Joseph, is found to be pregnant by the Holy Spirit. Oh, you're going to believe that, right? "Honey, I wasn't with anybody. It was an angel appeared to me, a miracle." But as Joseph was going to do what was right with Miriam, his wife, known as Mary, but she was a Jewish young lady named Miriam, which then through Greek, Latin, coming to English, comes to us as Mary. He was just going to deal with this privately rather than put her to public shame. But an angel of the Lord appears to him in a dream and tells him, "Don't be afraid to take her as your wife, for what has been conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit, the Ruach HaKodesh." Oh, by the way, if you're going to use Hebrew, might as well pronounce it correctly, especially if you have a Messianic Jewish congregation. It makes sense, especially if, as a leader of it, you refer to yourself as rabbi. So you may have heard it mispronounced growing up. Maybe it's mispronounced in your synagogue, but Kodesh is accent on the first syllable, Kodesh, not Kodesh, Kodesh. I can give you the Semitic reasoning behind it and how in the development of the language and particular nouns called segulates, how certain things developed and helped, but that would not be edifying radio. And after years and years of working hard to build up a substantial listening audience, we could lose most of them in a matter of minutes. But it's Ruach HaKodesh. Everybody that wants to say it out loud with me. Ruach HaKodesh. Not HaKodesh. Not HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh. Got it? Now, she'll give birth to a son. You're to name him Yeshua because he will save his people from their sins. Now, some have argued that this indicates that the angel of the Lord was speaking to her in Hebrew. Could be. Now, it's unlikely because it would not have been her native language. As a young woman growing up in Galilee, a Jewish woman, she would have spoken Aramaic. She would not have spoken Hebrew as her native language, even if Hebrew was still used as a language of the scribes and leaders in Jerusalem, and used on some level among the common people. And there's a lot of debate that remains about that. Certainly Aramaic would have been her mother tongue. If this was spoken in Aramaic, you're to give the name Yeshua because he'll save his people from their sins. The Aramaic for save is a very different root. If it was Hebrew, call him Yeshua because Yoshia, he will save his people from their sins. Yeshua, who will save Yoshia, Yeshua, Yoshia. You see the closeness between those words. So is it possible that she understood Hebrew sufficiently to understand that word play? Or was it simply that she would have known as a Jewish woman that Yeshua had to do with Yahweh saves? You can debate it either way, but it is interesting. Then, all this happened in order to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet, the virgin or maiden will conceive and bear a son, and they'll call him Emmanuel. The name means God is with us. So he's quoting from Isaiah 7:14, the only time in the New Testament that that verse is quoted. So it's hardly a central messianic prophecy like Psalm 110 is often quoted, or Isaiah 53 is quoted a lot as well, or Psalm 2. However, it is quoted in a significant way here. When you go back to Isaiah 7, you see clearly that the original context has to do with a crisis in the days of King Ahaz 700 years before Jesus. What you also see is that when this godless King Ahaz, who wants to lean on Assyria rather than lean on the Lord, when this godless King Ahaz is told by the Lord through Isaiah to ask for a sign, he says, I don't want to test the Lord, meaning I don't want to lean on God right now or look to the Lord. I don't follow him the way you do, and I'm leaning on the foreign aid from Assyria, which Isaiah is about telling that it's going to crush you. Assyria is going to come through here and crush you. So when he refuses to ask for a sign as high as he wants, I mean, the highest heavens or the lowest earth, any kind of sign, Isaiah, speaking for the Lord, says that the Lord will give the house of David, so it's not just for the king, but the house of David, a very rare term in Isaiah and the prophets, the house of David, a sign, a maiden will give birth. Now, was she known and understood to be a virgin? Was it just speaking of a young woman? This can be easily debated. The Hebrew word does not explicitly mean virgin, although speaking of her in Alma, in terms of youthfulness, could have raised eyebrows. What's clear, though, is someone that seems to be just insignificant maiden will give birth to a child of great significance. I think you can make an excellent case that it'll be a child in the line of David, because there is an attempt to wipe out the line of David by the nations that are attacking Judah, namely Syria, Aram, and which is Syria, and northern Israel. And yet, Ahaz is a godless king on the throne of David. I take this as a prophecy about the coming king on the line of David. Does it mean born in obscurity? Is that the point? Does it mean born miraculously? Is that the point? What's clear is as the passage unfolds, it's one of judgment for Ahaz, and yet who is this Emmanuel, Emmanuel? Well, what's clear is Matthew doesn't just look at Matthew Isaiah 7:14. He's looking at the larger complex of Scripture, Isaiah 7, 9, and 11. And we see at the end of the second chapter that he makes reference in a tacit way to Isaiah 11:1, saying that the Messiah will be called a Nazarene, obviously a play on words from Netzer, branch, Isaiah 11:1. And then we see when we get into the fourth chapter that he speaks of the Messiah's glory in Galilee. What's he referring back to? The beginning of Isaiah 9. He's looking at the larger complex of messianic prophecy and setting Isaiah 7:14 against that.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Robert in Salt Lake City, Utah. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hello, Michael. I got to get some ideas, but I want to read something to you from Matthew 24, first two verses. Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay. Get my glasses on. All right. Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. Jesus said to them, "See not all these things, verily I say to you, there shall not be left one stone upon another, there shall not be thrown down." That when it says in verse 1, the buildings of the temple, does that include the Wailing Wall or not?
Yeah, actually, I was asked about this earlier this same hour, but just to repeat, that was not part of the temple proper. That was part of just the larger temple grounds as Herod expanded, but it was actually not part of the physical temple and not what Jesus was speaking about there at all. In fact, the temple was devastatingly destroyed, devastatingly. The massive size of the stones, it was an architectural wonder to build with stones that large and to bring them into Jerusalem at all. The fact that the Romans succeeded in flattening them is such a shocking fulfillment of prophecy that critics say, well, Jesus obviously didn't say that beforehand. He must have said, you know, that must have been written by people afterwards to make him look good. So that's how shocking it is. Luke, though, talks about Jerusalem as a whole, that not one stone be left standing on another. But again, that's typical prophetic language, which is basically speaking in broad terms and even taking snapshots of certain places as if that was the whole. Not every stone throughout all of the city of Jerusalem was overturned. But as I mentioned earlier in the hour, it would take an absolute fool to stand up in the midst of the rubble of Jerusalem, in the midst of the destruction and the horrific, mind-boggling suffering of the city and the people, and the massive devastation brought about by the Romans as they literally razed the city, R-A-Z-E-D, and say, look, there's this wall over there. Jesus is a false prophet. So this actually verifies things, the fact that there's virtually nothing that was left standing except an isolated wall here and there. Hey, Robert, thank you so much for the call. I do appreciate it. Philip in Ogden, Utah, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, sir. My understanding is that a betrothal is similar to a marriage, and if Mary was perceived to have committed adultery, she could have been stoned for that. So how are they not similar?
It's close, but not identical. In other words, something did actually happen with marriage, and it was at marriage that the wedding would be consummated, the relationship consummated.
That's my point. The only difference I thought was that they had not come together. So, but
right, that would be the primary difference. So obviously, a woman committing adultery after the two had come together would be an offense that would be even more severe than before. They'd be related. So the argument would be that the Hebrew word zanut or the Greek word porneia could refer to a woman who was betrothed who had sex with another man, before they're actually married. So it would be a high-level offense. And in ancient Israel, the death penalty would have applied. In the Jewish world at that time, there was a lessening of the death penalty for various offenses. But it would be a different word that would be used. This is an argument that's had. The word adultery would refer to something after the two of them had come together. But remember, we know that if they had come together in marriage and then she didn't have what would be the tokens of her virginity, the bloody cloth that would indicate that, in fact, she had been a virgin on her wedding night, then she could have been stoned. And that would be one of the arguments used, that she would have still had the bloody cloth with the birth of her baby, indicating, in fact, that she had been a virgin up to that point. But it's very close.
I understood the Levitical
law.
I understood the Levitical law to read that if she had dishonored herself before marriage, that she could have been stoned, or that, well, that they...
Yes, exactly. And the proof would be when the two came together, exactly. But some, Philip, have argued in Matthew 5 and 19, when Jesus says the only legitimate cause for divorce would be sexual immorality, that he didn't use the word adultery there, so he was actually talking about a betrothed woman. So it is debatable. Hey, Philip, I've got to run, but thank you for the call and for furthering our discussion here. Again, it's different than engagement. It was a commitment far beyond engagement. So you would say in between engagement today and full-blown marriage, but closer to the latter in many ways than the former. Thank you for the call. I do appreciate it. Earlier in the show, we had some callers who were thanking me for my appearance on Piers Morgan last week. And of course, we got flooded with calls, with texts, with emails, with comments, and a host of different settings that blessed and encouraged me. I always take appearances before the secular media especially seriously, because I realize that that is the one exposure to the gospel that they may have, or the one exposure to a believer standing for righteousness that they may have. I take it especially seriously. And I also know that I'm speaking for you as I speak, that I'm speaking on your behalf as I speak. So I take it with even extra seriousness. So thank you for your positive comments. And when we talk about being your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution, that's exactly what we mean. And as we've appealed earlier in the week, I want to do it again, and these are the last 2 days we'll be doing this. Your generous year-end gift of any size, I want to send you, as our token of appreciation, my book, 420 pages, Authentic Fire. It is a book that we're hearing from people constantly. They got it, couldn't put it down, that they're blessed by the tone of grace and humility, reaching out to others in the midst of our differences. And yet, stirred, we're hearing from people who say, I'm convinced now that the gifts of the Spirit are for today, reading the book. It's a $25 value with postage. We're simply asking you to be generous and help us, however you can, at the end of the year, to be your voice, to be a voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity, to help represent you to the world, to the Jewish people, to the church. And it's your gifts of support that help us do this. And 100% of what comes in will go right back out into our ministry outreach. So would you call now, 1-800-278-9978. Again, that number, 1-800-278-9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. Or just go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and you can click donate there. And when you do, just put in the note requesting Authentic Fire. My bottom line today, if you want to rightly understand the New Testament, especially the Gospels, you've got to read them through Jewish eyes.